What happens to a dream deferred? Does it dry up like a raisin in the sun, or fester like a sore and then run? Does it stink like rotten meat, or crust and sugar over like a syrupy sweet? Maybe it just sags like a heavy load, or does it explode? Langston Hughes struggled as a poet. In 1946, his fortunes changed radically when he was asked to write the lyrics to the operatic version of Street Scene, or the Broadway version, maybe we'll say, an Elmer Rice play that was being turned into a musical by Kurt Weill. It was after he got that commission that finally he was able to buy his house. Finally, he was able to have a level of stability in his life, and able then to take other appointments. So, for example, he began a one-year appointment as a visiting lecturer at the laboratory schools at the University of Chicago in 1951. And that gave him a chance to bring together some material he had been working on for a while, including that short poem that introduces the longer work, which is A Dream Deferred. Dream Deferred is 1951, and it's just a few years later that the Montgomery bus boycotts propel Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King into a particular place in our national consciousness. And it was the experience of organizing with very regular people about a central issue. I love the notion of the buses being something about which one organizes. I think of Baltimore and what the heck we have to do about the end of the Red Line project that we were organizing support for, and what we're going to need to do. And maybe some leadership will arise out of our situation that will come to great prominence when we organize about how the buses might change and what might be resurrected of the Red Line project. But it was that moment when organized people said, "We will not sit at the back of the bus." When organized people said, "We will find another way, thank you very much. We will not participate in the segregation that you have imposed." Martin Luther King came to a new prominence. And of course, he shopped around his dream speech, not the dream deferred, but the dream he wanted yet to promote. In 1962, and then in 1963, almost as an afterthought, he was encouraged to say a few words about the dream. And he said, "Let us not wallow in the valley of despair, I say to you today, my friends. And so even though we face the difficulties of today and tomorrow, I still have a dream. It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream. I have a dream that one day the nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of the creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood. I have a dream that one day even the state of Mississippi, a state sweltering with the heat of injustice, sweltering with the heat of oppression, will be transformed into an oasis of freedom and justice. I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today. I have a dream that one day down in Alabama, with its vicious racists, with its governor having his lips dripping with the words of interposition and nullification. One day, right there in Alabama, little black boys and black girls will be able to join hands with little white boys and white girls as sisters and brothers. I have a dream today. I have a dream that one day every valley shall be exalted, and every hill and mountain shall be made low. The rough places will be made plain, and the crooked places will be made straight. And the glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all flesh shall see it together. When Ta-Nehisi Coates writes about the dream, he writes not about a liberating dream, but a dream that's like a drug, a dream that is so real we can't see reality, that the reality of our aspirations and our best thoughts about ourselves and our convictions about if you just work hard enough, anybody can make it in America, that dream is something of which we must be freed. It is not a liberating dream. It is actually an oppressive dream. My dear colleague, Alma Faith Crawford, in talking about having a 360-degree look, perspective, at the way we are with each other and the way we are in this world, says that we need to be set free from our fantasies. For white people, the fantasy that I didn't do it, the fantasy that I'm innocent, the fantasy that I didn't cause this racism and therefore I don't have to pay attention to it. The fantasy that undoing the racism that is inherent in our culture can be done without other white people being pissed off, other white people being confused, other white people rejecting white folk who are traitors, traitors to the way we are in building beyond the dream. I still have a dream. I think that what Langston told us and what Martin told us and what Ta-Nehisi tells us, those are all true. But I think the perspective of the Black Lives Matter movement is a perspective that I need to pay attention to. You know, I was invited during the uprising last spring to participate in national conference calls about how the Black Lives Matter movement might respond around the country, not only to what was going on in Baltimore, but what was happening throughout the country, and then also what people in other places were doing to stand in solidarity with Baltimore. And in the midst of those conversations, I was so struck by this group of young leaders, leaders in their 20s and their 30s, leaders who are largely women, largely black folk, and people who say that the Black Lives Matter movement is about the liberation of everybody. Because every life is important, every soul is sacred. And what they say is that racism is so fundamental, so foundational to the economics and the politics of this country since its inception, that if we find a way to declare that beyond the racism of this culture, black lives matter, then we will set in motion the possibility that every person could be liberated. Someone asked me if this was a leaderless movement. And you may remember that the Occupy movement, which said we are the 99%, prided itself in some ways of being a leaderless movement. And there's an argument for that that says that's compelling. You know, when there's a key leader to a movement, if you take him out, you can really set back the movement. So the notion of having a leaderless movement is not a bad notion. But what the Black Lives Matter people will argue is that they need a leaderful movement. Not a leaderless movement, a leaderful movement. A movement where each of us feels a sense that we have agency and capacity, and working with one another we can have authority to do great things that can turn around the way things are now. A leaderful movement. That's the movement that I believe is part of what resides of my dream. There was an analysis of the world in the older movement. I taught it. We talked about the three-legged stool, right? We talked about one pillar of the stool being commerce, that the marketplace was foundational for us. We said that governance was another leg of the stool. And then that third leg of the stool was us, was the voluntary associations that shaped the culture, that shaped raised the ethics of who we ought to be beyond the bureaucratism of government, beyond the mercantilism of the marketplace. But the centers like us would talk about what was really valuable, what was ethical and moral, what was spiritual. Well, the problem of that is that it's about jockeying and competition and confrontation among pieces. You want to find out where the weakness is of the bureaucratic function. You want to find out where the weakness is in the marketplace. What corporation is ready to crumble? What laws are no longer enforceable? I mean, it's about weakness. And then taking advantage of weakness. But what this movement says, it needs to be about strength. About our capacity to sit down with an elected official, to be in relationship with them, to find a way to change their mind, to find a way to get them to do the right thing, and yes, to hold people accountable when they're not, because otherwise we'll all be back in the dream. You've got to wake them up out of the dream. But you don't look at the owner of the business, you don't look at the corporation as necessarily evil. They might be the partner that you need to be in relationship with. And you need to hold them up to some standard. But it's not this three-legged jockeying thing. It's about all of us are in this together. And so coming up with a sense of how are we calling more voices to the conversation about the fact that we must change the racial dynamics in this country and in this culture? Agitation is not our only form. Bold action, bold vocalization, but sometimes cooperation, sometimes calling people not out, but in to the best that they can be. Self-interest is not our only motive, but shared interest may be the way forward. And activism is not just about the activist who works him or herself to death, but about leadership, which emerges out of relationship and claims authenticity and seeks a shared vision and dreams a mutual dream. The last thing I want to say is the encouragement of the Black Lives Matter leaders to build a movement that is sustainable, to not require everyone to spend all of themselves, but in the work to include all of ourselves, so that when someone needs to say no to taking a job, that's not a problem. It sets up some challenges, but it's good for a person to know their limits. When someone's working too hard and it's a person who just doesn't have the capacity to self-regulate, then a sister or a brother can say, excuse me, you're taking a day off and you're going to take your children to the park, because our movement needs parents who love their children and take them to the park. And it would be malpractice, activist malpractice, for you not to have quality time with your kids, because we don't want them to grow up hating the movement. We don't want them growing up feeling that they were orphaned because our parents were so busy doing whatever. And we also don't want the parents to overconsume and buy them gifts and blah, blah, blah to compensate for the fact that they're not there. That's not sustainable. We'll eat up the earth just working out some of our bad stuff with our kids. No. A sustainable movement thinks about the whole people and allows whole people to bring their whole selves into this work which is meaningful. I have a dream, yes, but my dream is that I will stay woke. I will not be left asleep when these meaningful things are happening in the times in which we live, but that I will stay woke to who I am and the capacity I have, the strength I have, the gifts I have, to stay woke to my capacity to build a relationship with you and for us to figure together how we change this place, how we lift our lives together, how we make this place more the kind of place that we imagine it could be, where people are invited to be here with our whole selves, when we're here sad, and we're here glad, and we're here mad, and we're here scared. All of us are welcome to this place, and we have the capacity to handle it. That's the dream that I have. That's the hope that you bear with me. And to work toward those ends, that's the promise that I'm ready to give. Blessed be.